Hello and welcome to Ancient Futures, where we get a bit meta and talk about talking about talking. Today I'm joined by Amy Landry, who hosts her own podcast called Living in Alignment, as well as the Study Yoga Summit, in which a range of speakers, including me, discuss timeless insights from yogic traditions. Now, this has long been Amy's passion. She's an experienced teacher of yoga and Indian dance, as well as a practitioner of Ayurvedic healing. So her focus is on sharing inspiration that weaves together wisdom from all of those sources for everyday life. I was therefore honoured to be asked to contribute to the Study Yoga Summit, and you can find out more about it via the link in the show notes, including, of course, details of the other contributors. It runs live in the week of April 29th, and recordings are available afterwards. Now, just to give you some background on this conversation, I realised after Amy had interviewed me for the summit that I'd done most of the talking. So I thought it would be fun to turn things around and hear from someone else who hosts a podcast talking about ideas, about her own life of inquiry and the transformative power of the sort of knowledge that will be discussed in the summit. Just before we get started, though, I'd like to mention that I'm doing something similar myself around the same time. I'm hosting an immersion that shares insights from the early Upanishads, and that runs throughout May with a mix of live conversations and some pre-recorded presentations. And you can find out more about it and sign up to join me at truthofyoga.com. Now, finally, for more information about this podcast, as well as to support it as a paying subscriber, which I deeply appreciate if you feel moved to do so, go to ancientfutures.substack.com. And now, without further ado, let's dive into the vastness of yogic wisdom with Amy Landry. So, Amy, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Daniel. It's always such a pleasure to chat with you. Great to be here.
Well, thank you also for inviting me to have a chat with you. And for anyone listening, this is going to be a bit of a peak podcast moment in that I'm going to be talking to you about you talking to me, and then we're going to talk about talking to other people. So in at the deep end.
I love it. Great. Let's
so
do it.
To give people a bit of context, the recent interview I recorded with you was for what you're putting together in the form of a summit, which you know, is not a gathering of world leaders, but a gathering of perhaps you know, in some contexts people talk of themselves as thought leaders. I personally can't stand the term, but it's people who are saying things or presenting things related to yoga that you find inspiring. And you've gathered together you know, a number of influential voices, and I'm honoured to be among them. And yeah, I think it would be interesting to help people understand a little bit about how this came together, and particularly the title of it, Study Yoga. And that was for me the most striking thing, because you always hear people talking about practicing yoga or doing yoga, but you don't hear this word study so much. And as somebody who's often presenting courses requiring people to think of themselves as students and to engage in some study, I was intrigued. So why call it study yoga?
Great question. I suppose the driving force behind that is because, well, on a personal level, I see myself as eternally steeped in studentship. I have this hunger to learn, and it can be a dangerous territory to have a hunger for knowledge, because then it's always seeking and seeking rather than assimilating, digesting and applying. So I'm very conscious of that. But particularly as a yoga teacher and having mentored a lot of teachers as well, I think it's really important that we drive home that yoga is, and it sounds like a very stereotypical thing to say, I think at least in my world, it's a lifelong path, it's a lifelong practice. And that means it's continued study, continued inquiry, continued questioning and critical thinking, learning, unraveling, which you obviously have done so much in your work, as particularly in the realm of the history of yoga. This is such a huge area to dive into. And I think it's endless. And this is what's so fascinating. And when we commit to studying yoga, first and foremost, particularly as a means to deepening our own experience and also doing our best to retain some of the truer essence of yoga, let's say, I think it's for the good of all. And it's a very simple title, but I think that simple works. It attracts people who feel drawn to studying yoga, to going deeper into their practice, who are yearning for more. Because sadly, with the globalization of yoga, as we know, with the evolution and innovations of yoga, which in many ways have been very positive, it's been detrimental in some sense because so many of us are missing out on the let's say the nectar of the path and the deeper teachings and the wisdom that can come from immersing oneself in these transformative teachings and the more subtle layers of yoga when we think about yoga in the bigger picture, not just being a postural yoga or a system of techniques. So I created the summit to draw in the people that resonate with this. They're looking for the yoga that's beyond the mainstream or the superficial, let's say. And by superficial, I'm not trying to be negative or critical. I just mean like surface level, people that want more than the postural yoga. And it's not to set aside the postural yoga. It's not to say that that's not yoga or that's not good enough. It's not negative in any way. It's like, can we do this? And what's next? What is there? What's deeper? Where can we go with this? Because I think human nature is to stay comfortable. And yoga is not necessarily comfortable, really. And so, yeah, I hope that helps just to summarize, but that's the driving force. And I thought, well, study yoga. I know it sounds a bit silly, but the alliteration, Study Yoga Summit, just felt like was easy to roll off the tongue, simple, and hopefully fairly straightforward for people to feel connected to.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and it sounds, in a way, if we were to sort of drill down into some of the connecting threads in what you were saying, that the whole essence, so to speak, is related to knowledge. There's a kind of knowledge that yoga is pointing towards that's sort of beyond the mind. But yeah, in order to figure our own way out of the confusion that gets in the way of accessing that knowledge, we need to engage the mind. And so there is some knowledge that needs to be acquired for the dismantling of, let's say, wrong knowledge. And yoga is often presented as vidya, a word in Sanskrit that means, effectively, knowledge, and it corrects for the problem of wrong knowledge, avidya, which leads to us thinking we know things when actually we're just lost in confusion. And so, some way of addressing that by actually just talking about the ideas that frame yoga practice, I think is essential. And I wonder why it is so infrequent that this takes place in the yoga world. You go to pretty much any yoga studio, and there'll be a timetable full of various styles of yoga class, which basically means, for the most part, making shapes on mats. Where is the class about knowledge? And how are people supposed to get any kind of handhold without that? I wonder what you think, as somebody who's been involved in teaching yoga extensively. Why there is such a lack of this?
Well, my first instinct is sadly to say it doesn't bring the money in. Realistically, look, I've never been a studio owner, but I've taught in many studios and been fairly close with almost all studio owners, if not all of them, that I've worked with and for. And I think it's a no-brainer. You're not going to be dripping in riches as a yoga teacher or a studio owner by any stretch of the imagination. And hopefully we don't do it for that means.
We still need to eat, though. We've got
Well,
bills to
of
pay.
course, of course, of course. And we look at the householder tradition. We are encouraged, through the teachings, the Vedic teachings, that, we do need to earn and we do need to earn a living. And the pursuit of our dharma is going to generate that wealth. And so it's not to diminish wealth, but I think that the reality is that postural yoga classes are what is most popular. Now, it's going to take, and it is taking it, some people to make the changes to shift the paradigm. And one thing I've personally learned as a yoga teacher over many years is that through my own evolution, let's say, on the path, my own deepening, my own evaluations and inquiry and questioning, and all the changes that have come from that, especially in how I like to teach and what I like to teach, because I'm not teaching for what's popular and trendy. I'm teaching for what I think is going to most serve. I've come to learn that the students will come. They will find you if you stay in that place of integrity and you feel very aligned with what you want to share. And unfortunately, that is not necessarily well received in a lot of yoga studios. And also, sadly, in some settings, a teacher's experience is also not necessarily particularly important either. And understandably, there is the money question, and how much do we need to pay our teachers, and how much money are we earning, and what's the most popular class, and what are people coming for, and let's just give the people what they want. We do see a lot of discourses and satsangs at various studios, but they're not a regular occurrence. They're not a weekly occurrence. And now that I'm saying this, one thing that's sort of landing for me is, well, the reality behind that is maybe we don't have enough teachers that are necessarily at a point in their journey where there's been enough maturation and application of knowledge to be able to take people into those deeper teachings. There are so many yoga teachers now, and what we need is for yoga teachers to deepen their knowledge, deepen their practice, not necessarily by looking at another 100, 200, 300, 500-hour course, but working with people. Maybe it is in shorter courses or different formats or through apprenticeships, or, COVID's been a blessing in that sense. A lot of stuff is online now. We have access to so many incredible people to learn from. But I think that there is a lack of genuine, let's say, wisdom, because we always talk about how knowledge applied repeatedly over time, consistently, becomes wisdom. And we look to our elders in society for that wisdom, generally speaking. And I think that maybe that's also lacking in many yoga communities. And that's just natural because of the popularity of yoga. There's a boom of yoga teachers as well. And we've just, yeah, even in many places where I've taught and where I've moved to the city I'm in now, there is a lack of what I would call senior teachers and people that have really lived this. And age does definitely play a part in that. I mean, it's not the only thing, but if you're 60, 70, even 50 years old, you've really lived. And that life experience, I think, is beautifully translated through the yoga teachings as well. It can be. So perhaps that I think that they would be the main factors. There's the financial side of things with studios, and then there's also perhaps a lack of, or maybe the balance is off. Let's say maybe there are enough teachers out there with the wisdom. Maybe they're not all on social media, that's for sure. Pushing, driving the numbers, driving the classes, driving the events, and promoting. They're staying humble and just doing things old school, let's say, if you will. So yeah, I would say that that's my sense anyway, through my personal experience. I hope that
Oh,
resonates.
thank you. Yeah, I mean, coming back to the money thing, and tying it together with the social media dimension and age also, obviously being younger, physically mobile, attractive, and extremely online leads you to a position where you might have lots of followers, and it's a no-brainer for a studio to, slot you into the schedule and make sure that, there are, I was going to say bums on seats, but it's more feet on mats, hands on mats if you want to go to the fancy classes. And
Totally.
so, therefore, anything that's teaching people how to be like that or how to emulate people like that just takes off. And anything that's mainly, let's be honest, not necessarily criticizing it, as you say, but trying to point out that that's just, basically doing things with the body.
Exercise.
Yeah, basically. Then you're immediately, you're you're damaging the brand almost by existing there. And so there's an aversion to that. It's welcome in certain contexts, like teacher training programs, or as part of a broader, offering. Or if you happen to be one of the global celebrity yoga teachers who, includes that as part of the other offerings that, might also take people into new techniques or, new capacities with techniques. But it's all about the techniques, and imagining that yoga is a thing that we do, I think, is part of the problem. So my personal, I guess bugbear is the fact that very few people today seem to recognize that, originally the term yoga was not something that people did. It was the outcome of doing other things. It's a state of being. And therefore things that access that state of being can be tools towards the state of yoga. There are all these compounds in Sanskrit that talk about various things, whether it's yoga through the practice of devotion or, yoga through moving your body around. It's still accessing a state through a method. But if you think that the method is the thing, then there's no orientation in terms of where you're trying to get.
Precisely. And you
I
see it
end
in
up.
India as well. It's
That's
not just in the
true,
Western
true.
world.
Yeah,
You
very
see
much
this
so.
emphasis now, particularly in more recent years, of the catching on to the trends in the West and implementing those, particularly in the major cities. And in some sense, I think, okay, that's a natural evolution, but it is concerning to see that happening, that, let's say, dilution, if you will. I am hesitant to use terms that might be negative because that's not my intention, but as you said, I think language is really important. So when we are looking at the things that we're doing and the techniques in the yoga class, if we can find a better term for it instead of calling it yoga, and this is why I love the term vyayama, because this is the word for exercise and this is primarily what we're doing and it's great for us. It's totally something even in India, the Indian subcontinent has been done for a long time in different ways, different forms, and it's great. It's so important, especially for the modern body in the modern world. But yeah, we have to really, I think, have the integrity to start to question, well, what is it that I'm really doing?
And of course, it can be, enormously life-affirming to get better connected to the body, especially in our modern techno age, where we're all not only lost in our minds, but, through the mind, zapped into a screen somewhere and, completely disconnected from our bodies, never mind the outside world. So there's definitely a place for it, but it always helps to have a bit more context. And as you say, that is diluted more and more. And it's not to get all purist or become the yoga police and tell everybody off for what they're doing. It's just to note that, unless this this message continues to resonate, the connection will just sort of vanish. And yoga over the years has been many different things. And if it only became a word for exercise, that would be a shame, because there's something much deeper and richer that it can also point towards. And I think that was sort of the message that I picked up through, looking at the presentation of what the summit was about, seemed to be sort of your intention behind it. And I'm curious, given that you've spent quite a bit of time in India and involved in other aspects of Indian cultural, let's say, body discipline, in that you're a dancer. You're originally a dancer, I think, in Australia, and then touring before you got into Indian traditions of dance. But you've got this engagement with Indian culture, and I wonder how that has led to you reappraising what you thought yoga was when you started out. How have your travels and studies in India shaped your relationship with this world of yoga?
Well, you're right. Yes, I do come from a dance background. I was forced into dance retirement, though, through injury, a couple of accidents, actually. But at the time, I had been practicing, let's say, as we've already talked about, practicing yoga, practicing primarily postural yoga and pranayama. But my whole life, I had a spiritual yearning. And so I very quickly went into very entry level books and texts on the eight limbs and, the pretty standard philosophy and picked up from local ISKCON community a copy of the Bhagavad Gita and so forth. And very quickly also came to Ayurveda. So very lucky to be drawn into these deeper aspects of the path. And it was actually on a particular teacher training that One of the teachers on the faculty brought my awareness to the classical Odissi dance, which comes from Orissa, which is in eastern India. And as soon as I saw it, there was this very visceral, emotional sense of knowing that I had to study this dance form. And I had been to India prior. I'd actually spent 3 months in India a few months before this happened. So I'd already been to India. And my first trip to India, as I said, was 3 months. And the first half of that trip was with my husband. The second half, I traveled solo. He had to come home and do a master's degree. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot in that first 3 months, in terms of the culture, integrating into the culture, feeling comfortable there as a woman, feeling comfortable in the culture. And it was one of those places that, as many people describe an experience when they travel to India, it just felt like home to me. Even within the chaos and the intensity, there was an undertone of peace for me being in India. And of course, having been immersed in yoga for many years prior, and I had at this time started teaching already. I'd been teaching maybe for 12 months, I believe, approximately. And as soon as I got back home from India, I knew I had to go back. And basically, every year I was saving money to go back to India and pursue Odissi dance at a school in India. And it all felt so natural to immerse in these other form, sciences, arts of India. Because, and one thing I've continued to, over the years, try to uncover is all the overlaps. They're so intrinsically entwined with each other in terms of the physical training, but the philosophical teachings underneath them all. Like, I don't see them as being separate forms or techniques. I mean, they are in a very literal physical sense. And so, yes, India has been an experience that has immediately deepened my understanding of yoga. And I think that as an Australian person, as a Westerner, it's really important. In fact, for anybody out there, if we are not from the source culture, I believe it's our duty to ensure that we are diligently applying ourselves to the path in how we practice, share, teach, and integrate yogic teachings and all the various arts, sciences, and systems that have arisen out of the Indian subcontinent. So going to India, and that's part of the reason why I take groups to India as well for retreats and tours, is because I know this cultural experience has the capacity to enrich our understanding of and direct experience of yoga. And I am reluctant to even use the word yoga because it almost feels too simplified to say that. But it's very transformative. It depends on the type of experience you have in India. You know, if you have a very sheltered five-star experience, very luxury experience, to me, that's very disconnected to the reality of life in India and the cultural context. Obviously, it'll give you a beautiful experience. You'll have a great time, but it's a very different experience. So just going to India for the sake of going without too much thought is not necessarily going to take you to this place that I speak of. But I think I am also hesitant to say, because I know that it would be argued, but I do feel it's essential for people at some stage to go to India if they do deeply care about their path and their practice and respecting the Vedic traditions, the yogic traditions, and all the systems and sciences that have come out of India. And trying to, if you care deeply, if people are out there and they care deeply about learning all the facets of yoga beyond mainstream, then going to India is a surefire way to be able to do that 100%. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm, conscious of some of perhaps the counter arguments. I mean, these days, one that people like to bring up often is, encouraging people to fly is a bad idea. We can park that one, I think, for the moment. But in the context of actually, what is yogic about India? There's all sorts of things in modern India that are deeply unappealing and very much at odds with yoga. Even down to the the very hardline approach used by some people in the Indian government to conflate yoga with their own political agendas. And all of that's not very helpful either. But at the same time, this is the cultural context in which yoga arose, life in that part of the world. And there isn't something directly replicable elsewhere because it's a different culture, it's a different context. And we're not obviously able to rewind thousands of years to whenever it was that yoga first began. We're not necessarily even able to tap into a living continuity of that. We have no way of knowing how much has continued without being modified, because there's an enormous amount of change in the history of yoga. But it is still a context in which, yoga is understood as part of, a way of being and a living tradition in that sense that is, I think, broader than the one in which most people in the Western world would situate it. You stop somebody in the street, what is yoga? They'll talk about shapes on mats. Yeah, I agree with you there. And I then, wonder for you, what does it mean to make yoga something broader than, a system of techniques that you teach people in a group class? What actually does it mean to live in a way that's in alignment, as the title of your podcast puts it, with this broader way of seeing and being?
One of the common, it's a dry way to explain this, but taglines I have used over the years is that I like to share timeless wisdom within a modern context. And that's really to suggest that I like to bring these, I don't want to say ancient. I don't know if ancient feels good, but because what is ancient? What is truly ancient? These teachings into a modern world where they can feel applicable and relevant. And so it's really about trying to reveal and unveil the subtle timeless teachings underneath the outer presentation of these techniques and practices and art and so forth. So that we can tap into that which will continually assist us in cultivating, let's say, not the state of yoga in terms of liberation, but the state of yoga in terms of the internal steadiness, stillness, a sense of alignment with universal cosmic rhythms, etc., which could sound quite esoteric to some people to say such a thing. But as I have studied over the years, not only through yoga, but also through Ayurveda, I've dabbled a tiny bit into Kalaripayattu, South Indian martial art form. And then, of course, through Odissi. There are, as I touched on briefly earlier, there are common threads there that start to reiterate the timelessness of what is underneath them all. What are we trying to tap into? And so, I'm not sure if this is directly answering your question, but yeah, I think how can we integrate into our day-to-day life a sense that we are in integrity and in alignment with the fundamental teachings that are beneath the surface level, beneath, okay, let's be in ahimsa, let's non-harm, let's such a truth. Like, we make things very simplified, which is great because it's practical and applicable, yes, in day-to-day life. So I'm not denying that, but there's something beneath that in every art and system that I've touched in from India. And I'm not necessarily going as far as saying liberation, but there's something that we're trying to distill down by distilling all the teachings and trying to come to one core sense. It's almost something that is challenging to describe in words because it's more a sense, it's something we're feeling or a state of being that we're going into that really, I think, is the foundation of all these systems that I've been immersed in. And then how to operate in daily life, sensing that that is ever present. And again, I know this sounds very maybe esoteric, bit stretching the imagination, perhaps for some people, but it's for me, it's looking for the timeless teachings. What is the thread here that is tying everything together that we can touch and we can tap into that is going to guide how we operate every day, the way we behave in the world, the things that we choose to do, the way we communicate with people? And of course, no one's perfect. I'm not perfect. It's a continual inquiry. This is why I love study and research and so forth, not just for the intellectual joy of it, which I do love, but I'm trying to, it's like I'm trying to uncover. It's like peeling, and it's a horrible cliche because everybody uses it, but peel off the layers of the onion and go inside,
Well,
what's at the core.
it's a cliche for a good reason. I mean, it talks about, the actual nature of things. The best cliches are commonplaces because they describe what is hard to put into words, and they've found a good, metaphor. And the problem is really, in some ways, that the thing we're talking about that is timeless is beyond words. It's just the relationship to reality in the moment that is an embodied presence, and at the same time is completely beyond the body and beyond the mind. So language doesn't really exist for it. So it's taking off all these layers of, identity and accumulated baggage that is getting in the way of just seeing and being clear. It's almost impossible to talk about, and the more we talk about it, the further away from it we can get. And sometimes studying is a great way of avoiding it rather than being present with it. I remember telling one of my teachers I was going back to university to do a master's degree, and he said, "Oh, just be sure to take it all lightly and don't get too lost in all of that." And I could see his point up to a point, because in the end, for an inquiry to be fruitful, it has to have some orientation, it has to have some direction to it in a way, it has to have some sense of being able to navigate for oneself when one is getting better aligned with this, whatever it might be that we can't put into words, and what's, leading us away from it. And we can only figure that out in our own mind body system, and guidance is there from these old texts, but it's not always directly applicable because we're living in a completely different cultural context again. And even going to India won't plug us into the matrix of Patanjali's guidance or whatever it is that we might, reach for from the shelf in an attempt to make sense of making shapes on mats or how to live after having done that. So, we have to have our own language. And I think that's one of the most important dimensions of study, taking the responsibility, fully squarely on our own shoulders to relate to this stuff here and now, and to be able to operate for ourselves in that space, and to not be searching for the teacher who's going to give us something that we can rote learn and regurgitate and, call that wisdom rather than actually trying to access it.
It reminds me of even just the study of Sanskrit. And of course, through all your studies and research and so forth over the years, you would have had this experience. But when we have a deep reverence for language, especially such as Sanskrit, we start to kind of see this, what we've been talking about, or what I was trying to convey is that there are these words, they have a certain sound resonance, they're very old, it's a very old language, and there's no simple translation for any word. It's not like we can pick a word and everybody just agrees on the translation, and there's context to everything. And it's so beautiful and so layered. And by trying to reveal or unveil the essence of each Sanskrit word, but then each Sanskrit word with another, it takes us to these deeper layers of meaning. And it's not like we're necessarily trying to get to a specific destination, but just allowing ourselves to stay immersed in that state of constant inquiry, and allowing ourselves to remain open. And I think that sort of tying into what we were chatting about earlier is that, instead of focusing on what we might feel is wrong or feeling disheartened by anything in yoga land, such as even, we haven't spoken to this, but even such as misappropriation or heavily diluted, distorted portrayals of yoga, I think we need to be fueled by the desire to do better and to shape, excuse me, to share the nectar, the essence, the beauty, the depth, and the richness of what we uncover through our continued study and observation and application, and we ask ourselves, how can we uplift? How can we preserve? How can we collaborate to continue to sort of excavate and thereby experience and then potentially pass on what we reveal or what we've learned from the multifaceted diamond that is yoga. And I really get this from your book, particularly. I found it such an incredible book, an incredible tool. It's not about learning something, going, this is how it is, or that's how it is, and this is right, this is wrong. It's constantly questioning. And even though we may not have answers, it's through the process of questioning and being open to learning without necessarily receiving any answer, even ever, we, I think, remain in a far more receptive state and a far more emotionally steady and neutral place. And that doesn't mean we're, zen all the time. Like there's emotion there where we're living in the world, but yeah, we're looking for, I think there's some beauty and some steadiness that can be found in remaining positive. How can we uplift? How can we uphold? How can we do good? But remain open in that. We're not necessarily just looking for answers, but we're just looking, we're just seeking. And I think that this is a really wonderful way to uplift. And again, circling back in, this is one driving force behind curating the Study Yoga Summit, bringing together teachers who I believe are aligned in that they all serve the yoga community, the global yoga community, in a way that assists us in all rising together and all together really upholding as best as we can what we know to be more of the true essence of the yoga tradition. There's plenty of that superficial stuff out there, and I know that there are so many people out there seeking something more, seeking something richer, and the community of people that are looking for more. And so that's why the summit brings us all together, brings all the guest speakers together to offer and share what they do with the community, so we can plug students into their incredible offerings and work in the world, but also just so participants can connect with other people and feel a sense of solidarity, and shifting their practice into an even more richer one. So I know that was a long, long, long circle we just
No.
went into, but yeah, just tying back into where we were at the start of the conversation. And yeah, I think that this everything we've talked about really drives home the value of and the purpose behind the summit. So
I'm very happy to return there, and also it gives me an opportunity to repeat one of my favorite clarifications about my rather audaciously titled book, The Truth of Yoga, that there isn't one truth. There are perhaps as many different paths to truth as there are people. And there's certainly, an enormous amount of disagreement within traditions of yoga. There are many different ways of looking at this, a project that we've been talking about, or path that we might, be able to walk. And we're not all drawn to the same one. And it's therefore possible, not just in understanding the meaning of a particular Sanskrit word, depending on which cultural context we're coming from, or lineage, or philosophical background, it's also possible to disagree quite constructively in a way that's conducive to inquiry. And it's through disagreement sometimes that we learn. It's the ability to hold this tension of opposites together, that we can find something that points a little bit beyond this idea that there's discord and we've got to pick one or the other, but there might be some synthesis that could arise from considering opposite points of view. And so with that in mind, I'm curious to hear, given that you've got more than a dozen people who you've spoken to in recent weeks for this, curious to hear about what they didn't agree about. Were there any striking ways in which people had slightly different perspectives on what yoga is, or what studying yoga might mean, or in what they wanted to present or emphasize in talking to you?
That's a really cool question, actually. I love that. And in some sense, even though it's a bit of a boring response, I'm kind of pleased to say that I don't think that there was too much conflicting ideas about it. And I think that that really drives home how all the people I've been able to bring together for this incredible event are just, there's a really lovely, almost synchronistic connection with the bigger vision. Every single speaker is speaking to a different topic, facet. We're going into Jyotish Vedic astrology, we're going into the yogic diet, we're going into householder wisdom, like yoga in daily life, dance as yoga. We're looking into the Karana and Nataraja and the influence of Nepal, because a lot of people associate yoga to India, but actually there's a really, Nepal's not just about hiking. And so every speaker speaks to really different areas, and yet they all pertain to the same thing. They all come home to the same place, which is so exciting and so beautiful. And every single conversation I've walked away from, yours, literally every single person I've interviewed, I've walked away with some kind of teaching or a learning or contemplation that has like stayed with me. Basically, it's stayed with me until the next person I've spoken to, and then there's been another one. And I feel so wholeheartedly thrilled that people can access these summit sessions, because they really are transformative, particularly if people can tap into every single conversation. It really gives me faith that I think yoga is actually moving in a good direction. There are a lot of people such as yourself doing really great work in the field of sharing yoga, and shifting the direction and the paradigm of many practitioners, and thereby just enriching their lives so much more. And I think it gives people such a sense of relief, like, oh, wow, I found my people. Oh, I found teachers. I found masterful people in their field that help me go further along the path. And I think when I look back at my own path of yoga, there was always a yearning for something more beyond the physical. Even though I was a dancer and I did really love the physical practice, and it helped with a lot of physical injuries. I was a very severe asthmatic. Pranayama helped me tremendously. Like, the physical practice of yoga, I believe, is incredibly healing, but I was always desiring more. And I think right now my efforts are to help other practitioners find the people, find the books, find the study that I would have loved to have been able to find so many years ago, to propel them forward along their path, as soon as possible, really. And as I said earlier, the blessing of COVID is that so much is online now, and that's been a gift to many of us in many ways. People can study with yourself, and I've had access to teachers that I would have had to travel overseas to be with, and it's been a tremendous blessing. But yeah, look, in terms of the summit specifically, there are a couple of little interesting things, but nothing major. Interesting perspectives on the yogic diet, I thought, was ch shifted my paradigm a little bit. And that's the thing. A lot of
In what
the
way could you say? I'm curious, because when you look at ancient yoga texts, well, not so ancient, but medieval era, the Pradipika, it says the yogi should basically eat lots of things that are sweet and pleasing and coming from a cow, and then there's sort of not much about what we might think of as a yogic diet, and the Bhagavad Gita just says don't eat too much.
Yeah, well, I think the perspective that there is no one yogic diet, even though we might like to say there's a yogic diet, but that there could be two extremes. And it's kind of like, when you know something but you didn't realize you knew it, you're like, yeah, that makes sense. So, for example, there was, the conversation about the extreme of basically eating nothing, even being a breatharian, like, these yogis who apparently ate nothing, and they just circulated prana, and they just lived off the air, or off very little food at all. Maybe one bowl of rice a day or something like that. But then we had the polar opposite, where the yogis supposedly could eat whatever they want. They could, like, literally eat feces off the ground and transmute it and transform it in, the poison into nectar. And so there's this sort of two polar opposites: eating nothing much at all, if anything, or eating whatever they wanted. It could be like, alcohol, it could be drugs, it could be anything, and being able to transmute that into something more powerful and more potent. So there's those two sort of polar opposite potential ideas about what a yogic diet is. But then there's also the idea of, like, well, it's vegetarian, it's sattvic, it's no onions, no garlic. Or is it actually very similar to an Ayurvedic diet? Or does it depend? Does it depend on if you're a householder? Does it depend? And of course it does. Of course it depends. But It's just interesting unpacking these. And as I've already
Yeah.
touched on, we're not necessarily finding any answers, but it's just so wonderful and enriching to look at all the potentiality.
A framework for questions is worth any number of cheap, quick fix answers, in my opinion, because that's something we can work with and can teach us to ask good questions for ourselves rather than just expecting again to get the answers handed to us on a plate. And I often think, coming back to what you were saying about trying to offer what it is that you would have liked to have access to yourself 20 years ago, that's how I see my own work, and I found it very frustrating going and asking my, early postural yoga teachers for some guidance on how all of this related to, the ideas of liberation or whatever else it might, I guess have been in my mind at that early day. I could, in theory, be aiming towards, and they just weren't able to talk about it. Whereas, had they at least been able to offer me some, I guess, rubric for assessing what it was I was trying to get at with my question, then I might have been, a bit more able to interrogate what they were suggesting I read with some more benefit. For example, they say, go to the Yoga Sutra. I just flicked through it, said, where are the asanas? They're not there. None of this makes any sense. What am I doing? And had it been more of a question of, well, basically, first of all, who's asking the question? And secondly, where are you expecting it to take you? And thirdly, is there anything other than here and now anyway? Then immediately, my mind's blown a bit and I have to start thinking about, okay, well, what is it I'm expecting somebody to deliver me? Or am I expecting to be delivered from here and now? And that's philosophy. That's not rote learning. So I guess that's what I was getting at. So the more we can be invited into uncertainty, as Krishnamurti once put it in one of his book titles, freedom from the known. I mean, he was a funny one because he liked to rant about gurus, but then he basically became the anti-guru guru. But still, freedom from expecting it all to be served up to you, and even to be, free from needing to hear the invitation to ask questions all the time. But the idea, it seems to me, of being a good teacher is to help people go away and become their own teachers, not to, make them dependent on showing up for more.
It's so interesting that you mentioned that because it just reminded me how Krishnamurti's books of his conversations, obviously of his discourses, were so pivotal for me in my very early days. So, I'm not saying anything's perfectly correct or what have you, or you have to believe everything or relate to everything in there in the same sense, but they are profound books, and I haven't picked them up for many years, but yeah, so profoundly pivotal at that time in my life when I came to find yoga. But yes, I think asking questions, and that's what I really love about your work. When you propose things online and through your social media, you're always proposing things from a place of asking a question. And I love that. And I, in a world where people are like, this is right, this is wrong, or this is what I believe, come in if you believe the same thing. I think it's, we need a little bit more open dialogue, and a willingness to maybe have no answers. And that's the beauty. And I always think of how there is a supposed meditation technique of constantly asking, who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Until the question just dissolves and there's no more questions. And it's not like you've necessarily landed on an answer, but the questions become redundant. And of course, we are here, human beings living in the world. And so we need to operate, and the questions are going to be there, and the mind is going to want answers, and or at least to inquire and understand. But underneath it all, it brings us back to, yeah, again, the stillness and the steadiness and what's beyond the inquiry. And that's what I think is so beautiful. Even if we don't attain it or reach it necessarily, at least not steadily and consistently in our day-to-day life, if we can just grasp it even once, it's like that knowing that gives us a peace of mind. And I think that drives the path, drives the practice, drives the studentship and the constant study, and willingness to stay receptive.
Oh, thank you. Yes, and coming back to the sort of theme of knowledge, the knowledge that is sort of beyond, intellectual knowledge, knowing in that sense, that's what it's all about. And from a place of knowing, we can speak knowledgeably, but otherwise, it's just information. And I'm curious from your own perspective. I know you're working on a book. In which you, as I understood it from conversation we had in the past, are weaving together some of your own experience as a practitioner and teacher to present an overview of, you know, what it means to be a yoga practitioner, but also some guidance in there too. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about what threads are connecting that project, and perhaps if, even if you have a working title that that might help us to get a handle on how it all hangs together. That would be interesting to hear also.
Well, it's funny because the book, so it's about 80% written, first draft, and I have had to put it on brief pause because of the work I'm doing with the summit and the very little windows that I have with two young children. But the book is, again, to fill the gap. It's the book I'm writing that I wished existed many years ago when I found yoga, and still to this day, I can't find it. And that's how I felt about, I feel about your book. It's the, and I know you've said this, it's the book that you felt needed to exist and you wrote it. And I almost see it as a bit of a manual, and it might be a bit of a dry word, but I imagine, okay, this is a problem that I saw, particularly with chatting to many students over the years. So many people see investing thousands of dollars in a yoga teacher training as the pathway to learning more about yoga. And I thought, how have we come to this problem? How have we how are we here? What is this all about? And not only is that a problem, but the next problem is that most people invest those thousands into a yoga teacher training and walk away underwhelmed and unfulfilled and still with many questions. And again, this just circles back to the beginning of our conversation. You know, teacher trainings can, not always, but can make, particularly studios, a lot of money.
Yep.
It's the main source of, it's the biggest hit of income any yoga studio can make. Of course, if you do not have a physical studio and you're a yoga teacher and you just work yourself or online or in person, fair enough. Like, that's going to be maybe your only source of income potentially, but many yoga studios offer them purely because they can see it as a huge financial hit of income coming through. So particularly once you've done the first round of a teacher training, everything's already created. It's just, you've got to duplicate. It's very easy to pull in your teachers that graduated from the teacher training previous and put them on your faculty for the next round. And it's very concerning, let's say. But I think that there are many students out there that are looking for more, and they see a huge investment in yoga teacher training is the only pathway. Then they go on to do yoga teacher trainings, or the people that want to teach go on to do teacher trainings, and they walk away going, well, okay, I'm not really where I thought I would be. And so my book, hopefully, is going to support those people first and foremost who are considering spending thousands of dollars to access information just to purely enrich their own path. And the book is, I think people need to go wide before they can go deep. They need to touch a lot in yoga to find where they want to go deep. I think there's a danger in going wide and never going deep. But the book aims to go broad, but offer a lot that is beyond the generic, okay, beyond Patanjali's eight limbs, okay, beyond just, okay, the next thing you've got to study is Bhagavad Gita, like all the stereotypical stuff we see. There is so much I've learned and uncovered in my own studies, a lot of which I share tiny, tiny bits of on my Instagram and whatnot, that I wanted to bring to people, because when I talk about it and share it, people just go, what? Like, I want to know more. And so the book, for me, I see it as a bridge for people to have a broad, beautifully broad exposure or access to many of the facets of yoga beyond the very stereotypical. And a lot of those are in there too, but taking people way beyond that. So then now they've gone wide, and then they can use the book as the guide to tap into where they feel most inclined to go deep. You know, and the book does have a very humble, small section on the history of yoga, but then it's also got the, you know, a whole section on the major texts of yoga. And by major, I don't necessarily mean the most popular or the most common. It's about what are the actually the ones that could take you really deep. What do you need to know about that maybe you don't know about? It's got a section that's more about the practical pathway from the outer body to the inner. So it's each section is a little bit different, and yeah, it's to help people find their way, essentially. Yeah.
Could we just jump in there and ask you, which yoga text would you say has been the most transformative for you to engage with?
Oh, I do love the Yoga Vashista, but more about the conversation. I found it deeply enriching. Sundaria Lahari text is a favorite of mine too. Like any Devi or Shakta text is beautiful. But in the book specifically, I wrote this section a long time ago. I believe the book focuses on an overview of the Yoga Sutra, of course, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, Bhagavad Gita, Yoga Vashista, and there's two more. I can't think off the top of my head, actually. You probably know what it's like when you've written something and you've been so intensely focused on it, and then you have to put it aside because you really have to tunnel vision into the next thing.
It literally is a brain dump. You have to dump it all out, and then you can fill your mind with something else.
Yeah, so I was writing that section of the book last year, and so it's like literally not front of mind right now. But one thing that I do find is, and you know this, I know you know this, Daniel, but and many of your listeners will, but when you are reading a text, so often it's so hard to get engaged in a text if you have no context for it, if you have no one guiding you into it. If even I even find one of the easiest things to help me get more out of a text is to have two different translations of it. And this is a really wonderful way to help you kind of look at, okay, what's really going on here? What am I trying to understand? What is this text trying to teach me? Because reading one text, one translation can potentially be quite dry, especially if you don't have the guidance of a teacher. I think accompanied by a teacher and dialogue and question is really, really important. If you are reading a text in isolation at home, you've just bought the book on Amazon and it's delivered to your door and you're just opening it up, a lot of this shastra is very challenging, especially for those of us that haven't grown up with the cultural context for it. It's just, it can be really challenging to enjoy. And it's wonderful to enjoy these texts. And yes. So, but that's the book. So I hope that it will be out soon and it will enrich the lives of many and just be a pathway, a bridge for people to leap off into something far more grand and wonderful. So, yeah.
Great. No, thank you. And if I may be permitted to be completely immodest and do a bit of marketing, should anybody listening want to dive deep into text with the support of somebody facilitating conversations, I have a course on the early Upanishads, which will be starting very soon, 29th of April. It runs live until May 26th. And that enables you to read passages from most of the early Upanishads, if not all of them. I think we've probably got a line from all of them in there. And we'll have group conversations exploring key themes and lots of opportunity to ask questions. So you can find out more about that via the link in the show notes. Coming back to where we started in your yoga summit, to which I will also be linking, obviously, and help people figure out their way there and how they can access. And anybody listening to this, long into the future, will also be able to get their way to the recordings. I just wonder, if you were to really sit back and think, what would you most like people to take away from listening to those conversations? If you could distill it down even to a sentence, just. What's the deepest aspiration you have for somebody tuning in?
I would say that I hope each participant leaves the summit with a sense of there is no hurry. There is no hurry. There is no deadline to achieving anything in yoga. And with that in mind, there is a community of people out there who value the deeper teachings of yoga and value upholding the various yogic traditions in the same way I do, and thereby just having peace of mind and having faith and faith in their path and their practice and just putting one foot in front of the other. And again, yes, that there's no hurry. These teachings are vast, complex. There's nothing to achieve. Just be receptive and allow yourself to digest and assimilate, because that's where the yoga is. It's through the assimilation and the transformation, where we eventually get to enjoy and relish in the wisdom.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to hearing everybody else's conversation. So far, I only heard mine and I didn't really hear it. I was in it. So more to come. And I'd like to thank you again for sharing the background to the creation of the summit, but also to your own yoga journey. And I look forward to hearing more about that book and to reading it hopefully soon. So for now, Amy, thank you again. Wish you all the best with everything. Pleasure to chat.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Daniel. Really appreciate it. It's an honor to be here.